U.S. soldiers who are proud to take pictures with the people who they've killed in Afghanistan, and sometimes the civilians that they've killed in Afghanistan. Your response to that kind of treachery and horrible behavior?
You know, the authorities and brutalities of these occupation forces is not new for Afghan people. These pictures is new, but the murderers is not new. That's because of the wrong policy of Obama's administration, the result of the surge of troops was more massacres, more tragedies, more pain. And they took a picture, they made fun with the dead bodies of my people. Now to put dust in the eyes of the great people around the world, try to bring these few soldiers to the court, which is not enough. They should have brought this Minister of the War, Robert Gates, and General David Petraeus to the court. Barack Obama's administration should be questioned for this wrong policy that, in fact, this 2 years, he proved himself as a second and even dangerous Bush for my people. He's expanding war in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Pakistan, in Yemen, support the Zionist criminal regime of Israel, and now start this brutal war under the umbrella of the UN and Libya as well. While Western governments, they are bombing us, killing our people, occupied our country, but we are so honored, justice-loving, great people of the U.S. They stand in solidarity with us, and they raise their voice against the warmongers of their government, but it is not enough. We are squashed between three powerful enemies, occupation forces, warlords, and Taliban. We want the withdrawal of the troops as soon as possible. Then my people will fight these two internal enemies, warlord Taliban. And the positive point is this, my people hate Taliban and warlords, and they will fight steadfastly till the end against them because of the hatred they have. And no nation can donate liberation to another nation. Only this is the nation can liberate themselves. But we need international support. We need educational support. I believe it is a key toward emancipation.
That was the voice of Malala Joya, a very courageous woman, former parliament member in Afghanistan. She is on tour in the United States, and you can follow her tour on AfghanWomen'sMission.org and find her. I'm Tara Darabji, here with Dennis Bernstein, broadcasting live from Dolores Park.
And that broadcast originally aired on Sunday. And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs every weekday and can be heard again at flashpoints.net. Executive producer of Flashpoints is Dennis Bernstein. Technical director, Eric Klein. To comment on today's program, please contact us at dbernstein@igc.org. Look us up on the web at flashpoints.net for our archived shows and follow us on Twitter. Our Twitter handle is Flashpoints News. Thank you for listening.
Call toll-free 1-877-5.
KBOO is a proud media sponsor for Portland Rising, March and Rally for Jobs and Benefits, No Cuts. On April 16th at noon, community members from all walks of life will join together to stand for jobs and benefits, not cuts. The march and rally will be in the spirit of Wisconsin, family-friendly and strong in spirit. That's April 16th at noon at Pioneer Square, located at Southwest 6th and Broadway. More info, kboo.fm/Portland Rising.
And you are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next on Between the Covers, the guest is fiction writer Peter Mountford, author of the new novel, A Young Man's Guide to Late Capitalism. And 11:30 Words and Pictures previews this month's Stumptown Comics Fest, featuring an appearance by Portland Mayor Sam Adams. And later, Gangolin talks about his epic graphic novel, Unemployed Man. Thanks, KBOO members, for your support. If you're not a KBOO member, you can become one now by going to the kboo.fm and website and clicking on the tip jar.
If
After earning a BA in International Relations in 1999, Peter Montford became an adjunct fellow for a think tank in Ecuador while the country was going through dire financial and political turmoil. Later, he realized that the think tank was a front for a hedge fund. The experience became the inspiration for his debut novel, A Young Man's Guide to Late Capitalism. Peter, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you for having me.
So what was it like working for a right-wing think tank in Ecuador?
Well, I had graduated from college, as you said, in 99, and I met a woman at a cocktail party when I was driving back across the country towards the East Coast. And she was my age. She was in her early 20s. And she told me that she was a fellow at a think tank. And I was astonished to discover that such a thing was possible. She said they were hiring interns. And I was going to D.C. anyway, so I asked if I could be an intern, and she said yes. And I started off as an intern, making $8 an hour. And there was some very brisk title inflation, basically. In a month, I was a researcher co-authoring these reports that were getting published that were cited in the Wall Street Journal and the Washington Post. And I was so young, and I had no idea what was going on. And I had no idea that this was kind of something I should be very excited about. And they made me a researcher and then a fellow and an adjunct fellow. And basically had myself and this other young woman on the payroll. I continued making $8 an hour. And they wanted us there to give a sort of a semblance of balance because they're a nonprofit and they're meant to be nonpartisan. And so we would just, were allowed to write about almost whatever we wanted to, as long as they didn't have to pay us very much. And I had a girlfriend who I'd been dating who was in Ecuador. And I said, can I go and write about Ecuador? They're having a major economic crisis, and they're abandoning their own currency. And no one's writing about it, so can I go and write there? And I did. And they said it was fine. You know, they continued paying me my $8 an hour, which went a long way at that time in Ecuador. And I lived there for a long time and wrote about the economy. And it was a very surreal experience because I'd never really planned on becoming a hack economist for a right-wing think tank, but there I was.
This think tank was a front for actually a hedge fund, is what you found out later, right?
In a way, yeah. I think that I'm not sure that they were a front. They just shared an office and the same staff, however that works. I don't know quite how it works. They didn't tell me. I didn't know about it. After I finally quit the job and moved back to the States in 2001, I was just looking online at news articles about Ecuador, and I found something that I had written that had been published without my knowledge. And I was reading it, and it was nice to see my work out there without, even though I had known it was going to come out. And I saw my byline said that I was, an adjunct fellow of this think tank and a senior associate of something called EMG, which I'd never heard of. And so I looked it up online, and it was Emerging Markets Group. It was a financial consulting firm that ran a hedge fund. And I found out their address was the same as the think tank. I don't think that they were very successful. I know that you can still find them online, fragments of their old website, but I have a feeling that they didn't do very well for themselves.
Yeah, but it's fascinating, this idea that here's this, you said you're being quoted in the Wall Street Journal.
Right.
And do you think this is why we get an analysis that is so unenlightened and shallow? It's like it doesn't seem, especially in a lot of the mainstream publications, that there's any analysis at all of a deeper impact that the financial decisions are going to have on people in these countries.
Yeah, I mean, I think that a lot of the think tanks, the way they operate, the smaller ones especially, like this was a smaller think tank, there are many, many of them, and they are mainly nonprofits, but they take corporate donations. And so there's a sense of, it's not official, but there's a sense of obligation that they will, if you're going to take money from Microsoft, that maybe some of your fellows will start writing articles about why Microsoft is being treated poorly by the judicial branch or something like that. And so that sort of is, I don't know, but they would never say it out loud, but it was certainly kind of something that would happen a lot.
In the novel, the manager of the hedge fund decides to only hire young people.
Yeah.
And why was that?
I think that there's a kind of exhaustion for the job she's looking for, which is an analyst who would actually travel to countries and do, because most of hedge funds, the way they operate, is it's done entirely by so-called quants or sort of number crunchers in offices in New York City or elsewhere actually now as well. But it's generally done largely mechanically. In the novel, there's a sort of a sense that there's increasing competition between the hedge funds. There's also, it's difficult for hedge funds to maintain competitiveness because they charge huge, huge, huge fees to their clients. So it's, and one of the things that this hedge fund does to maintain its competitive edge is they say, in addition to having our quants doing all the stuff that the other hedge funds are doing, we have, you know, these researchers who are out in actual countries pursuing actual physical leads, but almost like a journalist, trying to find out stuff before other people find out about it so we can act and have a competitive edge. And that's essentially his job. In the poorer South American countries, he's supposed to go to at least make sure that they're not missing an opportunity, because those countries have been ascendant for maybe 8 years, a lot of those poorer South American countries. And I think a lot of people feel like they missed opportunities in places like Peru and elsewhere.
You don't think that it has to do... he starts out in the beginning of the book, and he's kind of naive, mm-hmm. and he's kind of idealistic. Mm-hmm. That kind of all falls away mm-hmm. As things progress. And I wondered if the age of the person going in there had more to do with, for the same reason that we get very young people into the army, because you can get them to do things that if they're older and they've got more experience, they'll stand back and go, oh, wait a minute.
I could see that being, yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a certain, I think that kind of work is incredibly exhausting and alienating, traveling around to countries like that and trying to do that sort of work. And it's hard to convince somebody who has an established life, a family, say, to do that, even though the financial rewards are tremendous, but you're not home for 9 months of the year. You better not buy any plants or have any pets, because they'll never, you know, they're not going to survive. So there's a way in which it's an incredibly alienating life, and the shelf life of an employee in that kind of work is not very long. The shelf life of any kind of employee, actually, in most hedge funds is not very long. It can be very exhausting and stressful work for anyone.
Now, your father worked for the International Monetary Fund. Mm-hmm. So you kind of had insights into how they work.
Yeah, I grew up among that community. I mean, I ate breakfast at the IMF and the World Bank all the time. I still have a bank account in a credit union that can only be found in the basement of the World Bank. And I knew a lot of those people. And it was interesting to see that community. And then later on in life, to get to know people who worked, because that's obviously the NGO side. But then to also get to know people who had crossed over into investment banks and so on, because some of those people do move on to investment banks.
Well, it's kind of a good fit, because after you've been working for the IMF, you've mm-hmm. got, or the World Bank, you've got a lot of background knowledge into the economic and political systems mm-hmm. of these countries. Mm-hmm. And countries like Bolivia and Ecuador, they're kept in poverty because the wealth is either exported mm-hmm. or it's kept in the hands of a very small group of people.
Absolutely.
Do you see the same thing happening here? I mean, are we undergoing kind of our own shock doctrine?
I don't know. I think some of it happens here. I know that, for example, the history of Bolivia is, they call it el saqueo, which means the sacking. And it's been centuries long of, you know, there was Spain arrived and they discovered a lot of gold. And then they were very happy about having colonized Bolivia in that area. And then the gold sort of petered out, but then they found silver, an unbelievable amount of silver, which actually financed a lot of their empire. There was so much silver. They said you could make a road from Bolivia to Spain with the silver they found. And then that sort of ran out. And what came after? There was tin. There were other elements that they kept finding. And now, you know, the hills of Bolivia, the mountains of the Andes there are honeycombed with these ancient mines. And then in the 90s, they discovered natural gas, which was the same thing happened again. In fact, a Spanish company owns the majority of owned the majority of the natural gas in Bolivia. And then Evo Morales came along in 2005 and he took it back, much to the chagrin of a lot of Westerners. And he's now actually next month, he's just announced he's planning to take the mining interests back too from foreign powers.
Well, and but the reason that this sort of extraction is possible is because there's a whole lot of people who have no political voice.
Absolutely. I mean, in Bolivia, there was a tremendous, you know, there was, you know, 70% of the people are indigenous, and they had never had an indigenous leader until 2005. And they, you know, they've had a string of tall white guys essentially running the country for a long time. And Ecuador is much the same. That's really changed in the last 10 years in a lot of these countries. It's really, really different now.
Yeah, but I think what we're seeing here in the United States is a kind of a reverse of the process that's happening in South and Central America, because where they're starting to get voices, we're starting to, you know, there's a lot of problems with the elections.
Sure.
And then they're trying to dismantle any of the unions.
Absolutely. And there's a disparity, an increasing disparity between wealth and the rich people and the sort of the middle classes or lower classes in the United States. And I mean, and it, some places are just that's unbelievable. The disparity is incredible. And like somewhere like Brazil and Mexico, which has both countries have a number of billionaires, and they also have just vast, vast swaths of very, very poor people. You know, the United States is, you know, edging perhaps in that direction, but I don't think it's anywhere near, obviously, as severe.
Yeah.
Yeah. Having spent time in those countries, it's a pretty intense thing to see. Yeah.
So what you're saying is what we've got here, as bad as it may be, is still miles above where they are.
Yeah, it's incomprehensible, the difference. Yeah, it's really extraordinary. I mean, Bolivia is the poorest country in South America, and it feels almost at times like you're in a different century.
Yeah. You're listening to Between the Covers. I'm Marianne Barasonic, and my guest is Peter Montford. And we are talking about his book, A Young Man's Guide to Late Capitalism. So the novel is actually set in Bolivia.
Yeah.
And it's at the time that Evo Morales is coming into power. He's just been elected. What do you think about the changes that he's brought to Bolivia?
I mean, I like a lot of other people, I was a little dubious at first because, you know, he's got an eighth grade education. He was a coca farmer for most of his life, and running a country is a pretty complicated job. And it's he hired a lot of his friends to be in senior positions. And I think, like a lot of people, I was worried that he was either going to become corrupt. Almost all of the previous leaders became corrupt, even the ones who set out apparently meaning well. But he's had an interesting legacy. I think he has become both, he's really stuck to his word in one way, really, really has. You know, he slashed his own salary down to a tiny fraction of what it had been, and thereby forced down all the salaries because nobody can earn, and who works for the government can earn more than him. So all the other people's salaries dropped as well.
Well, I can't imagine that the salaries were a big part of the corruption. I would imagine that getting a part of the extraction of the natural resources,
of course,
was.
and that's definitely the main game in town. But I think there's a lot of ways in which he has really stayed true to his word. I think that there's, you know, he makes some really bizarre decisions. He's a very erratic guy at times. You know, he.
Well, what do you count as one of his bizarre decisions?
I don't know where to begin. I mean, he kicked out the U.S. ambassador, and he says some crazy things. He's proposing to the U.N. to make Mother Nature, literally like the goddess of Mother Nature, because it's a religious figure, that it would be a crime to defile Mother Nature with pollution, and that somehow the UN would, I'm not entirely sure how the plan works, but the idea is that it would be like...
Earth would get a legal say in what's going
exactly.
on.
Exactly. It would be like you've literally committed a crime against a person or a deity, and the UN will go after you. It sounds like a cool idea, but it's a bit zany. I think it's
genius because sure. it's kind of like this balance to yeah. the idea that corporations are people.
Yeah.
And you're going to be at Powell's tonight?
Yeah, I'm doing a joint reading with my good friend Alexei Zentner, whose novel Touch is just out from Norton. And we're reading together at the main branch at 7:30. Looking forward to that.
Okay. That'll be, I'm sure it'll be really interesting. So you have Gabrielle, the young man in the book. Mm-hmm. He's in Manhattan on 9/11. Was that kind of significant?
Yeah, I think in a way it's, I mean, obviously that's when international affairs kind of came home in a way that was really hard to ignore. Also, you know, the book is slightly drawn from my own experiences. And after I quit that think tank, I did move to New York and I worked a job at AOL. It was kind of bleak. And in a way, you know, Gabriel's desire for money is inspired by that period of time in my life when I was, you know, making a pretty paltry wage and living, you know, check to check in New York City, and is kind of tough when you see other people your age doing quite well, and it sharpens your desires. But that was in 9/11. I was there as well.
Oh, okay, that's what I was
so
wondering.
That scene is drawn almost identically from my life, where I was going to work and I saw that the World Trade Center was on fire. I was living in Hoboken, and I was about to get onto the train, I was like, "Huh, World Trade Center's on fire. That's odd." And then I jumped in the train and went into Manhattan, and you know, and then there were people crowding the streets, and you know, the rest of the day proceeded as it did, and I was stuck on Manhattan for the next, I don't know, 18 hours or something.
Yeah,
couldn't get home.
That's gotta have been a really terrifying experience.
It was a very intense experience. Yeah.
So Gabriel starts out as this really likable guy, mm-hmm. but he kind of gets very greedy, and he makes a lot of decisions that ultimately, you know, are questionable. And you obviously didn't make a fortune in mm-hmm. Ecuador, but how do you think you would have reacted if you were presented with the same opportunities that he was?
I mean, I like to say that I would be this noble hero and that I would... you know, betray my employers who are, you know, I would see as slightly villainous and sacrifice myself for the greater good. But I just don't really think that the world operates that way. And I was, you know, when I was there, I was in my mid-20s as well. And I just think that you're presented with what looks like a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to really strike out and, you know, establish an unbelievably kind of, you can get away from the problem of the hunger for money by earning enough of it that you can get away from it. Literally, you can, you know, buy your way out of the problem of having to worry about it. And I think that if you are presented with that and you're in your mid-20s and you don't have a lot of things in your life like a wife or child or anything like that, and it's hard to be I don't think that people behave like that outside of Disney movies, you know, where they...
they walk away from the pile of dough because
yeah,
they
you know,
say it's
going to... It's going to ruin my chances with this pretty girl. I just feel like in reality, you know, I think Gabriel has a wonderful affair with Lenka, who's Evo Morales' press liaison, and they do fall in love in a way. And but at the same time, I think for him, he's in his mid-20s and he's saying... love will probably come along again, but I don't know if a job like this will ever come along again.
Yeah. There's so much in this story that you kind of go into economics, not just the economics of what's going on right there, but kind of economic theory. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you stop and think about it, economics and finance is so central to our lives because we live and die by the decisions that are made about that sort of thing. But there's very little, I think this is the only novel I've ever read that has economics as like the center of it. Why do you think that is?
I'm really baffled by that. And that's part of what I set out to do with the book was I've obviously lived among economists and I've done some work in the world. And I know it's very not only interesting, but it's obviously unbelievably important to the world we inhabit.
Although I think a lot of people are starting to get interested in it now
because
of what's been happening
Absolutely.
With the financial crisis.
And I think that it's appearing in other forms of art. But if for some reason, the literature that we celebrate in this country is often, you know, it seems almost antique at times where it's a version of John Updike or a revisiting of Sherwood Anderson or something. And it just feels... oddly out of touch with the world that we actually inhabit, which to me feels more like either an episode of The Office is maybe a little bit closer to our lives than, say, Faulkner, or, and these issues of finance, which remain bizarrely absent from a lot of our sort of realistic fiction. We have, thrillers and so on, but we don't have a lot of, character-driven fiction about people who are involved in this incredibly rich and complicated material. I find it really strange, and
you resisted the urge to paint any of the people involved in this in black and white terms.
Yeah, I very consciously resisted that because I feel like there's a lot of cartoonizing of these people. You get, Bonfire of the Vanities or American Psycho, where you have these kind of these villainous preppies who are running around with their Brooks Brothers suits and. I don't know. It just the world is not. It's not that simple, unfortunately. It's just I wish there were, because that would make everything much easier for us. But the world is unfortunately very complicated, and these people aren't good guys or bad guys. They're just regular people, and a lot of them are their own worst enemy. Or I don't know. It's a very complicated situation.
Gabriel kind of seems like he's kind of stumbling along, kind of clueless a lot of the times.
Absolutely.
And then he gets manipulated by other people.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the book starts off and he's bad at his job, essentially, and he's afraid that he's not going to be able to keep it because he knows that the shelf life of most people with that job is not very long, and he knows it's incredibly lucrative, so he's just thinking, how many months can I keep this job? How many paychecks can I get before they fire me, before they realize they made a mistake and fire me? And I think to his own surprise, he realizes he is actually pretty good at it, or he gets by the end of the book, he's figured it out. He's good at his job, and it's a transformation that he accomplishes at no small sacrifice to other aspects of his life.
In a lot of ways, he understands that what he's doing is wrong.
Yeah, I think he does
to an extent. His mother makes sure he knows. I loved the fact that his mother is such a central part in his kind of moral compass of the world. Because again, it's realistic.
Yeah, it's a weird story in the way that he's surrounded by really strong women. He has his mother, his boss, and these one woman who he has an affair with, and one woman who is his girlfriend, and they're all fantastically strong, powerful women who are far more intelligent and in a way. Composed than he or many of the men in the book are. I mean, it's a strangely feminist book. The women are all fantastically strong, and some of the women, they're sort of angels and devils on his shoulders. And it's not that he's a hapless fool, but he is young and he's trying to find his sense of how to be in the world, and they're an important voice for him.
Yeah. So now you're working on another book that's going to have somebody from the World Bank as a central character?
Yeah, it's actually related to this book. It's about a character who's a minor character in this called Vincenzo De Orsi, who's a World Bank official. He's a vice president of the World Bank who kind of obliterates his career. He's a widower, and he obliterates his career, and I think in a moment of haste, and then has to sort of rebuild his life, and it's about a lot of the sort of the things that go into a person's identity. And it's a bit more of a quiet book, but it works in the same milieu. I mean,
well, it's almost like you start out with the idealistic young man, and mm-hmm. goes off and goes for the money. And then you're going to take someone who starts off with the money and becomes idealistic, it sounds like. So you're kind of like doing a reverse kind of.
And it's about a lot of the sort of the fragility of how our sense of who we are is. I mean, how easily the structures that support our identity can fall apart. Like if you lose your job and you lose your family, then suddenly who are you anymore? And so it's a book about that, and it's a book about a guy trying to find his way politically as well.
You seem way too young to be writing about something like that.
You know, that's funny because it all is oddly autobiographical. It
really
is. In a way, I mean, it's all drawn very vivid, very directly from my life. Whatever I write, and even I wrote a short story about a woman in Sri Lanka trying to get her mother to sell a hotel, and it was deeply, deeply autobiographical. I can't explain how.
Well, but you lived in Sri Lanka for a while.
Yeah, as a child, I was there for 3 years at the beginning of their civil war.
So that must have had an impact in the way that you saw the world. I mean, being in a country going through civil war.
Yeah, it was unbelievably intense, And it really, I mean, a lot of my travels have affected the way I view the world, but that was the earliest and most formative, I would say. 3 years there,
Yeah. So, have you read the book Confessions of a Hitman?
I've read parts of it.
Economic Hitman.
Yeah.
And we were talking earlier, and you were saying that you thought parts of it were unbelievable.
To me, it seems it's more ideologically driven than I'm comfortable with. I feel like he has a major axe to grind. I think it's a bit of, you know, white hats and black hats. And I'm not sure that the world is quite so neatly organized. I mean, as I said, I wish it were good guys and bad guys. But I just don't think that people are quite so diabolical in reality. I think that, you know, I think that people end up in making bizarre and occasionally horrific decisions. But I rarely think that people are so kind of sort of evil in that way. I just don't think that that's, I've met many of these people and they just don't seem quite so...
They
evil.
Seem like nice people.
Well, they just seem like they're not, you know, they're not driven by sort of such horrible, I don't know, they're just not like that.
Yeah, but you can see where their decisions kind of wind up with these horrible outcomes.
Absolutely, definitely.
And yet they keep making the same kinds of decisions because,
There's been some change. Definitely, there's been quite a few changes, I mean, over the last 15 years, a lot has changed in the world. But, I mean, the last 15 years, I think, has really changed all of the paradigms. All these organizations and the companies operate in very different ways.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I've been talking to Peter Montford about his book, A Young Man's Guide to Late Capitalism. And you can see Peter tonight, 7:30 at Powell's and on Burnside. Peter, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
KBOO is a proud media sponsor of Terrapin Events' Bridges to Brews 8K 10K Run Walk. The race will start at one of Portland's original breweries, Widmer Brothers Brewery, located at 929 North Russell, and then you'll go over the Fremont Bridge and